You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to the Wheelhouse.
On a scale of 1 to 10, he's going to hit a 10 on every nice guy mark until he gets out on the mound. And then he's going to chew you up, and he doesn't really let you go.
Starring Jerry DePoto.
And Jerry DePoto to the plate with the 2-2 pitch to Alex. Swing and a miss. He struck him out on the fastball.
With Aaron Goldsmith.
To see what he's done this year, Jerry, to just despise walking guys even more than he did last year, to work the edges of the plate better than any starting pitcher, maybe better than any pitcher, period, in Major League Baseball.
And Gary Hill Jr.
That's Aaron's only way of scouting. He doesn't care about anything else. How they look coming off the
man,
bus.
Man, oh man.
It's time for the Wheelhouse. Here's Aaron.
Welcome once again. It is the Wheelhouse Podcast. It is our first in-season podcast in 2021. And Jerry, it's great to be with you. It's great to see you. Happy New Year to you.
Wow, Happy New Year. It seems so far past New Year.
Well, new baseball year, Jerry.
Oh, new baseball year. I wasn't as nuanced as you were in my presentation.
It's good to see you, man. I haven't, when have I seen you last face-to-face? It's been a long time.
I feel like inadvertently, it might not be face-to-face, but it's something over a Zoom. It's something while we're on a program like this in pregame for Root. But it is, it's not as often as I would like it to
well,
be.
Well, the feeling is mutual. And we are almost to the finish line of the first month of the season. We are right about there. And there's been a lot of good things happen for the Mariners. I think one thing that has continued from last year to this is it seems like the Mariners' schedule has been maybe at its most difficult right out of the gates, just like we saw last year.
Which I think makes the start we've been off to all the more exciting. You know, there's so many things that have not gone particularly well for us, you know, in terms of, you know, sustainable performance. But if you would have told me going into the season that we were going to wake up nearing the final month of the season with a record such as we have and played the schedule that we have played, that's pretty remarkable. We've had unquestionably the most difficult schedule in Major League Baseball during the month of April, and we've managed to hang in there against teams that frankly, when we were leaving spring training, most didn't think we were going to be able to go toe-to-toe with, and the fact that we have is very encouraging.
You have gotten used to life not on the road. You got used to it last year, but as a general manager, is this an odd thing, a strange thing for you to do, or do you just find yourself pulling up onto the couch each and every night when the team's out of town?
I am pulling up onto the couch when the team's out of town, which is new and unique. You know, this is the longest I've ever gone in my professional baseball life without traveling, whether it be with a team or out on some kind of scouting, you know, endeavor or going out to see minor league affiliates. It's been very unusual. And, you know, I'm quite ready to start traveling with the club again. And, you know, hopefully we can get to that point from a protocols perspective. And I think we are nearing that point. But, you know, watching the team at home, it has its rewards. You can see a lot on a TV broadcast in today's time that, frankly, you don't really get to see from the box we're given at a ballpark or when you're sitting in a seat, you know, 20 rows back and behind home plate. There is some advantage to it from a scouting perspective.
Jerry, one of the great treats early on this season for the Mariners has been the bullpen. We talked on the podcast probably at some point during spring training how it was almost inevitable that the most improved element of your ball club this year would be the bullpen, A, because of its struggles last year, but B, also because of the new faces that you had added to be in the pen this year. I mean, by any number of metrics, Jerry, this has been arguably the best bullpen or one of the two or three best bullpens in the entire game.
We knew that was going to happen.
the bullpen being the black magic of all of baseball.
There you go. It can't be. I mean, it truly, you know, when you are putting a bullpen together, you know, you can think through it. You can acquire names that everybody's heard of, pitchers who've performed in ways that you know, stamp what they're going to do moving forward. And you'll be all wrong. That's just not how it works. And, you know, it's a little bit humbling. And, you know, having done that as a profession, you know, pitched in a bullpen and gone through it can be a little up and down.
Does that give you any professional advantage whatsoever, having been a former reliever, to find current relievers?
No, it just gives me patience in waiting it out. But, I do think, and I said this going into last offseason, when we met with the media at the end of 2020 and we talked about the want or the need to address the bullpen, it was the understanding that it's probably not built the way you think it's built. It's not about going out and getting marquee names. It's not about going out and finding, seven guys who throw 100 miles an hour, although we tried. It's about finding a mix of guys who bring something a little bit different, who each provides maybe a different pitch style or a different angle or, different speeds and separations. And in a perfect world, right and left combination. Although I think that's a little less of a need than it might have been 2 years ago or certainly 10 years ago. So it really is a mix and match, and then find the right people who believe in each other, because it really does become a community. A good bullpen becomes a community, and now they feed off of one another, and guys start they start to perform above maybe expectation or ability, because there is an expectation among that group of six or eight bullpen guys that drive one another. And that's been so fun to watch with this group.
Feels like Will Vest is a great example of exactly what you're talking about. I mean, here's a guy who wasn't even at an alt site last year, right? And here he is this year pitching high leverage against the Dodgers and at Fenway Park against Boston, and has pushed himself into a big role early on and has done really well. It's amazing how it's worked out for him and has been such a great part of your pen so far this season.
He's been phenomenal. The things that Will has done, he hasn't spent all that much time on the mound, not just as a professional, but in his lifetime, dating back through college. He's got a lot of position player left in him. He's actually one of the better athletes that we've had, come through our roster in the last handful of years as a pitcher. And he's got a three-pitch mix. He's shown to have the courage to throw it over the plate. And I think what we're finding out about Will is when he gets in those moments, when there's traffic on base, he doesn't wilt. He just rises up and, he brings some energy to the situation. And he's not afraid to use his secondary pitches at the right times. And I think that's a really important aspect, is in an age where it seems like every guy that rolls out of the bullpen is throwing somewhere between 94 and 104. Will is able and willing to throw secondary pitches and use those swing and miss traits that he has. You're not going to get a lot of big league hitters to miss fastballs over and over and over, but you can get them to miss your secondary weapons if they're well located. And I think Will has done a very good job of that in the early going.
I'm curious to go back to something you said a moment ago about not having as great of a need in today's game as maybe 5 or 10 years ago to match up with lefties and righties out of the bullpen. Why is that exactly?
The three batter minimum is
simple as that.
Okay. The three batter minimum. It's nice still to have lefties in your bullpen. And Anthony Mishevitz is a great example for us. But in today's time, when you're facing the three hitter minimum, it's tough to find that pocket, mostly because managers are astute in building their lineups. They're not giving you that pocket where you're going to hit, three lefties in a row. And if you are hitting, two lefties in a three-hitter mix, it's usually guys like Michael Brantley and Yordan Alvarez. When
like silver slugger.
Yeah, flip a coin. You got a good enough shot with a righty or a lefty. So I do think that has minimized the impact of a more matchup-oriented pitcher, be he left or right-handed, and it has neutralized that. But if you get a lefty who has the ability to get right-handers out, in addition to making life more difficult on a left-handed hitter, that is as valuable or more valuable than it has ever been in the history of baseball, my opinion.
Can we get to a sneaky early favorite moment of the season?
I have a lot of them.
One of mine, I'm curious where this ranks on your list, is the Kendall Graveman swinging strike three Marwin Gonzalez thigh incident at Fenway Park. Like, I have never seen that before. You maybe, probably, I don't know, have, but that was amazing.
I feel like I've seen it before, but it's not. I mean, it is like perfect game rarity.
You know, and it's like the foot, right? It's not like
it's not the thigh.
It's like mid thigh.
Oh yeah, I've seen one actually a little bit worse than that. But you know, it's such a rare thing, and like Kendall, you have to have wicked movement on a almost exclusively on fastball or changeup, because it's got to be a ball that's running in arm side or on that cutter slider that's to the other side of the plate, where the movement is so big. And you know, the first time I ever saw it play out like it did with Kendall the other day, I was watching a game in Japan of all things. And
of course
you were. There was a third baseman for the Chinichi Dragons who wound up playing a little bit in the big leagues for the Dodgers later on. You know, this was while he was in his prime. And, you know, such a common thing in the Japanese hitting style, it was the Sadahara O teaching, you know, kind of, you know, wind up like a rubber band, get that leg kick, and then kind of simultaneously drift into your swing where, you know, you only have one foot on the ground. And I watched this hitter take that swing against a sidearm reliever who had just come out of Korea, who was making his NPB debut. And he threw him this slider that seemingly broke like 7 feet, and it just ran across, and it hit him in a region that would make it very uncomfortable for the normal person. But, you know, I think in the case of Kendall Graveman, what he's been able to do since transitioning to the bullpen, especially in developing his secondary pitches, has been remarkable. He's always had a great sinker. He's always been a good strike thrower. And, you know, now that great sinker is no longer 93, it's 96 and 98. And that those secondary pitches that were oftentimes not necessarily a primary part of his approach, even as a starter, they were only occasional used pitches. He's now using those pitches at a much higher rate, and I think it's making him an impact pitcher before our eyes. And boy, we needed it.
Yeah, he looks like caged and hungry every time he takes the mound. There's a certain intensity from Kendall, and you never know how it's going to translate right starter to bullpen, but he has embraced that role better than anyone could have ever anticipated or even hoped for, I'd have to think.
He really has. And in addition to embracing that role, and Kendall has a quiet burn to him all the time. You know, it's just, it's part of him. And he's such a good person, and he's really transitioned into a leader in that bullpen, in addition to kind of taking the reins in high leverage situations. What I'm most excited about is, you know, with Kendall and others in our bullpen, there has been such a consistency with that group, is that it's given Scott and Woody and Trent Blank, you know, the confidence to be able to use Kendall or Rafael Montero or Anthony Mishevitz against the pocket of the lineup that they think is most critical in that moment. And that is really what you want in bullpen management, is to have enough depth in your bullpen, enough impact in your bullpen to be able to use your best pitchers at the right time versus the right part of the lineup for that pitcher's skills. And we've been able to do that this year in a way that really we haven't been able to do in my tenure here. We've had some really good bullpens, but they were always anchored by one or two high impact relievers. And then we were struggling to find the depth in between. This group has been so good for these first, you know, 30 days or so of the season, that it has given us a lot of comfort in using the pitchers when we think the chance to maximize their impact is best.
In terms of impact performances early on this season, the bullpen is probably only really rivaled by the top third of Scott's order. It has carried this ball club, generally speaking, so far this season, and it's been incredible to watch what Mitch Haniger has done after missing, in essence, a season and a half, what Ty France is doing in his first full season in a Mariners uniform, and then Kyle Seager, who, after going through a little bit of a dry spell, came out of it just crushing like he was over the first few weeks of the season. It's been a lot of fun to watch those three guys at the top.
Really, and they're picking us up big time. You know, I think as we've gone into this month, and obviously our performance has been very good in terms of wins and losses versus a really tough schedule. And for the most part, it's been one of those, you know, you have a new hero every day. Some days it's one of the three hitters at the top of the lineup. Some days it's Sam Haggerty. Some days it's Evan White. Some days, you know, there's somebody else that chips in that moment. But the primary, the driving force behind our run scoring has been those three guys. And on any given day, when they're all doing it together, that's when we look like a real impact postseason contending type offense. And, you know, the guy that I've been most impressed with is Mitch Haniger, just because of how much time he's missed. And they've all three gotten off to fabulous starts. Ty France has been one of the best hitters in the league, truly since the day we acquired him from the Padres last year. But to miss as much time as Mitch missed and to come back seemingly with no timing issues, his resiliency has been far greater than we anticipated it being. And, you know, he's gotten a couple of DH days to take him off of his feet, so to speak. If that can serve as his off day and he's able to continue to bounce back the way he is, what he's doing and doing at the top of our lineup is pretty remarkable. And Ty has been the steadiest bat in really wearing a Mariners uniform over the last 2 years. And it continues today. You know you're going to get a professional AB every time he's in there. And I couldn't be more excited about the fact that Kyle Seager is doing what he's doing in April. You know, I can't say like that Kyle's performance is not shocking in context of Kyle's career. You know, Kyle's had a great career as a run producer, and he's always kind of he's been there. I've referenced it this way in our discussions. He's like a metronome. You know, you can push really hard on the pencil what he's going to do, and at the end of the year you're going to look up and like the old adage is he's going to have his numbers. But for him to be doing it in April is pretty atypical of Kyle, and I think A, we needed that, and B, it's been such a nice relief for our lineup, because frankly on most days the other two-thirds of the lineup really haven't been synced up or clicking the way we need them to be.
Jerry, your points on Mitch I think are spot on given what we've seen so far from this year. It's been incredible, and given the time he's missed, he's been so productive. It was interesting to hear him talk about trying to challenge himself leading into the season, in the offseason, looking for ways to fail. You know, he talked about going in the cage and scooting up 5 more feet. It's interesting to hear that mindset. And it worked, obviously, because it looks like he has not missed a day. I mean, credit to him. It's been really impressive.
I can think of many ways to fail, and I've, yeah, I've explored them all.
You try to avoid them while Mitch was trying to find them.
That's right, yeah. I can tell you where they're at. I think that's what really is among the most intriguing things about Mitch, and this really is true dating back to when he joined the Mariners, you know, postseason 2016 into 17. His focus on his training, his preparation for a game, managing the information, whether it's an opposing pitcher or it's what's happening with his own swing. And this really drips through to the performance center, the weight room, the dining room. He's always in tune with what he's doing and looking for new challenges. And, you know, I can't say any of that surprises me. I hope he continues to look for failure. If what it does is leads him to the type of success he's had this month, I think it's remarkable.
Yeah, he's been amazing, and maybe we shouldn't be amazed, but he's been amazing to see what he has done. And you referenced the bottom two-thirds, in essence, of the lineup. Now, Kyle Lewis has just recently come back after beginning the year on the IL. It has been a concern at times, I'm sure, for Scott and for you to see the lack of production down there. But also, at the same time, while wanting those performers to be better on a regular basis, it is maybe important to look at this through the lens of the at least current offensive environment around Major League Baseball. I do feel like we have this conversation like each of the last three Aprils around Major League Baseball, when like the batting average around all of the majors is at what would be an all-time low, on base, the slug, the whole thing. But this year in particular, Jerry, I mean, it has been really tough sledding for really all lineups across baseball. It is such a pitcher's game right now. It has been for a while. But Jerry, it feels like it's going that direction more and more each year.
And I wasn't old enough to really remember what the shift from the dominant pitcher's era, you know, the season of the pitcher,
right,
happened to be the season I was born. But the, you know, that shift, I don't really remember it. I was in diapers. But at the end of the day, I think we're in a similar zone right now, just in how dominant pitchers are today. And somebody smart once said to me that context is always more important than content. And we get very hung up, especially in baseball, on discussing the content, you know, the statistics that we're so familiar with. I'm among them. I'm among the biggest defenders. It's really important to remember to bring it back into context. And in the league that we're playing in right now, where so many pitchers are throwing at such a high velocity, where spin on breaking balls is really spinnier than it's ever been. I mean, this balls are spinning with more rotation than they ever have. And you know, when you have to combat that as a and we're doing it with shorter starts from starters that are going harder and then handing it over to relievers who have even better stuff. And you know, and they too are starting to throw more strikes or create more precision, especially at the top of the strike zone. And you know, it's such a hard time to be a hitter in this league. But like anything else, whether it's through, you know, experimental rule changes with the game, how we're going to adapt moving forward, the game will evolve to meet the challenge. And my guess is that we'll find a way to bring it back to some type of competitive center. But, you know, in the meantime, it really brings to light the need to have an approach like we've pounded for a number of years now, which is to really dominate that strike zone. You have to stay in the strike zone to hit, because if you don't stay in the strike zone to hit and you start stretching it out at today's velocities with today's spin, with the ability to get up above that strike zone, it's nobody really hits that ball that gets up above the top of a strike zone. And even when you start talking about the top third of the zone and what would be a called strike, in today's game, when it's happening at 95 to 100 miles an hour, like so many guys can do today, I can't even imagine how difficult that is physically to pull off night after night. But I appreciate the fact that you're bringing it into context, because there really is, you know, it's a tough time, and you just have to scrape and claw. That's why the walk is a really important thing. You
know? It's amazing to look at. The science is really on the side of pitchers right now, and we're seeing it with the stuff from your team. I mean, the fastball velocity, the pitch shaping. I feel like every hitter now is going up to the plate naked. I mean, you know exactly what the hot and cold zones are. And as you mentioned, the top of the zone has been, you know, it's been so tough for hitters. Big picture, would you be in favor of moving down the strike zone moving forward?
Well, I think inevitably it's going to happen, you know, and that's whether that is the next step, I don't know. But as you know, whether it is experimental rule changes in some of the independent leagues, or there are things that are being discussed at a league level, we're talking about all different ways, not necessarily to neutralize the impact of pitching, but to balance the field in a competitive way and create a more exciting ball in play type of outcome. You know, that's what the fans want to see as a general rule. We like seeing the ball hit over the fence. Everybody does. You know, but seeing more balls in play, more action in the game is an important element that baseball is in tune with, and Major League Baseball is in tune with. And I do think we're going to start seeing some rule changes that will allow that to be, you know, whether it's some adjustment to defensive shifts. It's some adjustment to the natural strike zone and the way we call it. I think those things will start happening again, because the seesaw is a little askew. You know, right now it is very much in favor of the pitcher, and we have to find a way to give the hitter an opportunity to get back into a competitive place.
We know that the numbers, and we've looked them up and we've talked about it, we've been beating the drum. For us, the real eye-opener was the White Sox series. And we've seen this top third exploited for some time now, but the White Sox did it to a criminal level. So credit to them.
I thought it was criminal.
Credit to them for having the arms to be able to pull it off. But we know that the numbers in the top third of the strike zone are, it's death for a hitter, right? And these are actual strikes we're talking about. We're not talking about the ball that rises just above, but actually in the strike zone. But even if you take the strike zone as a whole, the box, right, the outline that we see on the K zone on every telecast, every single night around baseball, the area where the Marcos of the world live, all the way around the edge percentage, we see Mariners hitters take those pitches, sometimes for strike three called to end an at-bat. But with the plate discipline that has been preached for so many years now, and it seems like is really beginning to take seed and cultivate, when you watch a game at home and you see a batter take a strike three call in the lower outside corner that's a pitcher's pitch, are there instances where you're upset by that? And are there instances where you're saying, no, that's exactly the right thing to do?
I think it's more B, you know, more often than not, you know, and this is a hard thing to do. You just have to, you take your poison. Because if we start swinging at those pitches, and again, I'm going to remind that the first month of this season, we have played the best teams in baseball. Mm-hmm. And we have faced a variety of the best pitchers in baseball and or the best stuff. You know, when night after night, you're seeing guys like Rodon and May and Berrios and Urias. And we have seen a steady diet of the real deal. You know, I mean, this is real stuff coming at you. And I'm not even I don't have to go back and mention the guys who've been able to go back and forth. Guys like Greinke and Gausman and Cueto, who we've seen really do it, and Urquidy, who've done an unbelievable job.
How do you remember every starting pitcher at the Mariners? I'm like, oh, yeah, they did
this
play.
Is
oh,
what
yeah, they
we
did
do.
Cueto, didn't they?
That's right. This is what we do. You know, but I think it's important to remember that in an era when pitchers are rewarded for pitching at the top of the zone, and these guys are doing it at that type of velocity, you know, we have to be more disciplined to sticking to the plan. And I don't mean to be disparaging to teams, you know, that aren't among the best in baseball. Eventually, we're going to get to teams that don't have those guys. You know, and we have to stay with that plan. Yeah. And, you know, and that's when the world will start to turn for us or the worm will start to turn for us. And I think the fact that we've been able to manage this while sticking with our approach, while not chasing outside of the strike zone with any frequency, in a way that represents lineups, some of the best lineups in the league. This is the way they hit. This is the way the Dodgers hit. This is the way the Twins hit. This is the way the Rays hit, you know. And I think it's an effective way to score runs. The fact that we've been able to stay in that approach and stay disciplined, if we can manage this until we get some type of relief in our schedule, I think it's going to be beneficial to our bottom line record in the long run. We're going to get a break somewhere.
While we are in Seattle or the team is on the road, there's a lot going on in the Valley of the Sun, even though it seems like a year since, it felt like we were there for a year, and it feels like a year since we've been there. Mariners minor league spring training has been going on, a lot of activity. It didn't start till the Mariners left Arizona. Can you kind of give us just a holistic snapshot of how that's been going, what's been going on, and what this, a very odd, at least compared to usual, Mariners minor league spring training has been like?
Yeah, it's been a month later, which is, you know, that by itself is unusual. We did build a bridge, which I think we spoke about on the last podcast we did before we left Arizona.
A year ago.
Yeah, seemingly. And, you know, we entered into a co-op league down in Arizona with other teams in the Valley, and we were able to build a bridge. It was about a 10-game space in between the end of Major League camp and the start of minor league camp. And the guys that were going to be left in that gap were some of the best prospects in baseball. And, you know, we were able to build a 10-game schedule where those players were still getting their innings. They were still getting their plate appearances and building on their reps. You know, so for, as an example, guys like Jared Kelnick and Julio Rodriguez and Cal Raleigh, you know, they're getting 3 or 4 at-bats a day against other teams' premium prospects. Yeah, in a time where they would have otherwise just been going through batting practice. And, you know, it doesn't seem like much, but at the end of that, when you have another 30 or 40 plate appearances, and then like we have over the course of the month of April, you go through a daily schedule where you're playing games and they're getting 3 or 4 plate appearances. You know, by the end of that set, you're now looking at 100, 100 and a quarter plate appearances that you would not have otherwise experienced. And that's been our focus this spring. Typically in spring, you're trying to bring guys along at a pace, mm-hmm. time it with opening day, you know, a couple of games, a day off, a couple of games, a day off. Like you see in major league camp, you might play 5 innings and then the next time out, you're going to play 7. This go around, we have taken our very best prospects like we did in last year's alt site, like we did throughout the summer camp last year. We have, and like we did in Instructional League, we've given those guys the opportunity to play every day and get as many of those plate appearances as we can because those are critical to their development. Now we're wrapping up minor league camp. Obviously, we've hit the goal line, which is affiliate baseball is ready to start, which we're all thankful for. We'll have our 4 top affiliates, our new structure, which is Modesto at low A, Everett at high A, Arkansas at AA, and Tacoma at AAA. They all start, and that's exciting as we begin May. One of the things that I'm most encouraged by is the pitching in our organization. Like we've talked about, it's a great time to be a pitcher, and right now it's a great time to be a stuffy pitcher in the Mariners organization, and we've got a number of them. And it's not just the marquee names, the Gilberts and the Kirbys and the Hancocks. We have got a dozen pitchers, 15 pitchers in our system that are all, you know, in that mid to upper 90s range with really quickly developing secondary stuff. Very excited about that and the depth in our system, and can't wait to see these guys start playing this week.
Can I ask you about one of those stuffy pitchers?
I love talking about stuffy pitchers.
George Kirby, so when he was drafted, it didn't walk anybody. I mean, we knew just master command, right? To see the velocity that we're seeing from down there from afar, I mean, sitting 96 to 98, touching 100, it looks like, from down there. I mean, to go with the command, that seems like a pretty good combination.
It's a good combination. I'll say this, Gary, you're a little light on the velocity. He's actually been up to 102.
Oh, 102.
In the spring. And he's doing it with what I would say is well above average command and control. You know, he's actually, he walked two guys in a game the other day, which
what?
Is, yeah. I felt the same way, but he was averaging 98 miles an hour. So I thought, we're going to give you a break on this one. George, when we drafted George out of Elon, you know, he would touch 95, 96, pitched at 93, 94, and he had multiple secondary pitches that he could throw for strikes. We've seen him really evolve in a different way, and now he's averaging 96, 97. He's touching north of 100 with his fastball. On a given day, you know, and we've seen this in shorter 2-3 inning outings, he's sitting close to his top velocity, which is, you know, in the upper 90s. And that's really exciting. He's learned how to maximize that part of his skill set. He's really come a long way with developing his secondaries as well. And, you know, the precision's always been there. We feel like with George, he just needs to pitch innings. And he could be as quick to the big leagues as anybody we have in our system because of that combination of physical stuff and polished command and control. It's kind of what you do in development as you wait for those things to come together. Now we just need to see him put it together for 5 and 6 innings in to start.
I'm using the term stuffy pitcher all the time now, just so you know.
Yeah, they're all stuffy.
Jerry, I have a thrilling stump JD for you.
I enjoy being thrilled.
It is wild, it is ridiculous, and it is somewhat topical. So the other day...
And it's a certain loser for me, correct? Yeah.
I think you got a good chance of this, man. I really do. It's going to be tough. There's a lot of answers to it, but I think you got it in you. All right, so the other day, as you well know, Vlad Jr. homered not once, not twice, but 3 times in a game for the Blue Jays. So it got me thinking. I was just curious. Like, what's the 3 homer history like in Blue Jays history, right? So I looked it up. Guys who have hit 3 homers in a game in a Blue Jays uniform. And as it turns out, there have been a lot of former Mariners hit 3 homers in a Blue Jays uniform. So with that in mind, 5, Jerry. 5 of the previous 7 players to homer 3 times in a game for the Blue Jays are former Mariners.
That's phenomenal.
Isn't it great?
Yeah, it's an amazing.
Thank you for enjoying. There are a few people. Gary is definitely one of them. There are a few people who can enjoy this enjoyment as much as we do.
I appreciate that.
I know you would. So I will give you, to help give you the time frame, okay? The most recent of the 5 players was 2017. The most distant was 2009. So a Blue Jays player, 09 to 17. There are 5 of them, Jerry, who are former Mariners. I have my
and had 3 homer games.
I have my pencil ready for you to cross off. The 2 that were not Mariners were Donaldson and Bautista, as you can imagine.
Seems like two guys.
Likely suspects.
So I've got 5 guys, 09 to 17. Edwin Encarnacion.
He did it twice.
Which is not a stunning thing.
But 5 years apart, by the way, which I also find amusing.
He was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, his run in Toronto was tremendous.
Unheralded run somehow.
Couldn't agree more. I'm going to say, could we be Jose Cruz Jr. on that list? No.
No, that's an interesting name.
Just lobbing it out there. How about Justin Smoak?
Oh, see, that's a great guess, but no, that's very, very heady, though.
Wow. I'm gonna write off against it here.
Well, one's impossible.
One is impossible. Can I tell you the impossible name?
Yes.
Please.
Okay. He had more home runs in this one game for the Blue Jays than he had in his Mariners career. John Buck.
Oh, I would have never got that. and I'm a big fan of John Buck, like the guy.
Yeah. He was a good dude, man. Very good guy. All right, so John Buck, who had one Mariner home run and had 3-1 game for the Blue Jays baseball, you know. You traded for one of these guys.
I don't know.
I don't know
if that narrows anything down.
I know you traded.
You just made it even harder. Yeah. You just made it even harder. Traded for one of these guys.
For one of these guys.
From the Blue Jays?
Not from the Blue Jays.
Adam Lind.
Yes, Jerry.
Ah, there you go.
Your own transaction history. All right, so I gave you John Buck, which is fair. You have two more.
Two more.
Yeah.
Blue Jays.
One was in 16. Mariners. And one was in 17.
16 and 17.
One of them is Canadian.
Michael Saunders.
Yes, Jerry. You got one left.
And the other would be...
I'm not sure if you're familiar with the story, but he once, during a day game in Seattle, smoked a pig in the parking lot.
What?
Yes. While the game was going on, he DH'd. He was a DH.
Got his four ABs.
Yeah,
while
and in between,
a pig is on the rotisserie.
And went and checked out on the pig.
That's phenomenal. Who is that?
Kendrys Morales.
Oh, another one that we've had.
Yes.
I'm a fan of the person there as well.
You know, it's not often that I get to actually stump JD. So
it's roughly every time we play this game.
Oh, I totally disagree. I completely disagree. I feel like you have at least a 60% win rate on this.
I will say going into that, I had more confidence when you were telling me it was between 09 and 17, and then the obscurity of the names.
Oh, we did enjoy, as we scrolled through the list, there have been a lot of three-homer games for the Blue Jays. Chris Woodward had a three-dinger game in a Blue Jays uniform. Gary, against who?
Against the Mariners.
Against the Mariners.
And the Mariners won the game.
There's a 6 degrees to Chris Woodward.
Yeah, baseball,
the Mariners,
man.
And the Blue Jays.
Baseball.
He had 13 career home runs.
can I fill you in on this, because I can't get it out of my mind? One of my favorite Adam Lind moments.
I love Adam Lind moments. What's yours? So,
you know, Adam was not a morning person.
Okay.
And spring training is a time for morning people.
Yeah, absolutely.
As a general.
Well, old spring training was.
Correct.
I don't know about new spring training, but you're right.
So old spring training, and when Adam first joined, it was generally old spring training rules. And Adam would come out every morning to do his hitting in the cage, you know, wearing a hoodie with the hood over his head. You couldn't tell if he was among the awake or still sleeping while he was walking. And it took him closer to midday to really start to liven up, which for Lindo was not, you know, like overwhelmingly vibrant. And we're standing at the cage. This is roughly that week where you know, hitters are taking their reps, getting prepared for live BP sessions. And we had the PA system out on the fields blaring music. That would, let's just say, it seemed like it was coming from an 8-track player with somebody who had, you know, a couple of cans and a string. It was not premium sound, and the music of choice, I would say, was mid 70s classic rock, which in today's time probably isn't the number one choice among players as they're getting ready on the backfields. And Adam Lind comes up, he's grinding his bat, still got the hood on, still looks like he's half asleep. The eyes are two-thirds shut. And he walks up and wedges his way between Scott and I on the back of a turtle, you know, the batting cage. And he's grinding on the bat, and he's listening to the music. And he turns around to Scott. And roughly his knowledge of Scott now is not, you know, it's days, you know, and not weeks, months, or years. And he looks at me and goes, "Skip, I got it. I got it. I can see you now." 16-year-old Scott Service, his lovely girlfriend, driving around Coon Valley, Wisconsin, in his 1968 Camaro, listening to a little "Don't Fear the Reaper." And then he nods and goes around and gets in the cage. And I turned around to Scott, and Scott is trying to grasp what Adam just said. And I just started howling at him, because now every time I see Scott and his lovely wife, Jill, I think of them cruising around Coon Valley in their Camaro, listening to "Don't Fear the Reaper." And it's probably something that never happened in Scott's life, but the convincing way that Adam broke that down, that's how he saw Scott. It's now every time I think of Adam Lind, it's the first thing that comes to my mind.
I'm amazed that he was had that much going on upstairs at that hour in the day to be able to come up with such an elaborate backstory.
Yeah, pretty sharp guy. Funny in a like super dry but glib, and a really fun guy to have on a team, I thought.
That's terrific. Jerry, we have a listener question for you this week, which I think is very interesting. We're talking about what was going on in Arizona. Joe Doyle wants to know about a great Washingtonian, Austin Shenton, who he says his bat is looking for real. He's getting a lot of time at first base. Do you still envision him, despite where he's been playing recently, as a potential second base or third baseman?
So the way we see Austin, and this is actually a great question, that what we're doing at the developmental level is trying to expose as many players to flexible defensive placements as they can, you know, or as we can. You know, there'll be very few players, position players, that we just stick at one spot. This year, as an example, we may do that with Noelvi Marte because of his age. You know, we just want to see him play shortstop. Our outfielders play all three. You know, Austin Shenton, like, you know, Tyler Keenan, who will, both of them will be in Everett. We're going to flip-flop them between first and third base because, frankly, when most players get to the big leagues, you're not going to play one spot when you first break into the big leagues unless you are a premium guy. You're going to be asked to do different things. And, you know, it's that's where we see Austin Shenton. It's probably where we see Keenan. It's where we see others in our system. And it's why we've been so aggressive in trying to place them around the field and give them the opportunity to play a lot of positions. Because when you get to the big leagues, you're more likely to do it as Sam Haggerty or Dylan Moore have done. And there are others who are in that camp, or even like Jose Marmolejos has done, where it's a little first, it's a little left, because that gets you on the field or in the lineup, and then you let your bat do the rest.
Was there a light bulb moment for you or others in your office where you decided that this was the path that you should go in terms of development? Because it doesn't seem like – this seems like a new concept, obviously.
Yeah, it's something we've talked about really since the day, you know, we all arrived, as the, if you want to have versatile players in an era where you're carrying more pitchers than we've ever carried, you know. When I broke into the big leagues, we had 11-man pitching staff, you know, and it's different today.
That's the bullpen now.
Yeah, it's true. and we have to be aware of the evolution of the way rosters are built. And in so doing, and in realizing the value of guys like I just mentioned, like guys like Hags and Demo, or looking back over this last decade, guys like Ben Zobrist, you know, that move around the field player, Marwin Gonzalez, they're – if players are prepared when they get to the big leagues to do that, they have a chance to thrive in that role. Luis Arraez with the Twins really stands out. Jorge Polanco, you know, if we introduce it to them when they get to the big leagues, you have a much bigger chance of a face plant. And then the bat never gets to play. And Shenton can really hit. Keenan can really hit. We want to make sure that these guys have as many avenues as possible to playing time. And, you know, we don't want to fix them in one spot, but move them around the field. And we do think that, like we did last year at the alt site, we will again give Shenton opportunities to play at second base. We've even talked about doing it with Keenan, who's a bigger, stronger bodied guy, but find out what they're capable of. I think anything short of shortstop is in the cards just to see what they're capable of.
As you rattled off Twins names, even Willians Astudillo. Catches, third base, obviously has pitched before as well.
Probably sells hot dogs in between innings.
He's doing everything, so you're right. That can definitely happen. Well, Jerry, this has been great. We so appreciate the time and all the insights, as always. We're going to get back on a regular in-season schedule now, so this will not be the last conversation, that's for sure. So we appreciate the time, and thanks for hanging out for a bit.
John Buck.
Ha 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 ha!